have been saved their own lives.
On the 18th, which is Thursday afternoon? Is it Friday?
Maybe.
Oh, all right. So in case anything goes wrong, we still have Thursday afternoon. All right. Okay. Today's Tuesday, so no, this week. We were initially given an indication by Mr. Frolic that he would schedule us on next week, on the 21st, 22nd. After speaking to Mr. Vapela, he indicated that they had only approved for us to proceed on the 18th because they didn't see any reason why we should push it to next week. I can't remember what they say, the planning next week, Tuesday 4. So I said to him that, look, in any case, our plan is that we should be finished by Wednesday. So we can't object. There's no basis why we should object to proceeding on the 18th. Is the 18th Friday or Thursday?
Is it Friday?
I think it's the 17th.
But it's just that we've got the extension until the 18th, so that's maybe we'll report to the house on the 17th.
I thought they've actually scheduled us for the 17th in the afternoon, haven't they?
Okay, sir. I'll have to start. But on the ADC, they've extended it until the 18th of September, so it's still the banker will still report on the 17th. No.
Oh, are we?
Yes.
Oh, all right. Okay. Look, I've been out of the country since last Thursday, so. Okay. You were saying? Proceed?
Yes, I got the weekly program, in fact, until we go on recess. And on Tuesday, there's a debate in the House on something. Then they're approving the appointments of the Human Rights Commission and then the appointment of the Public Protector, and it's a three-line whip.
Well, that'd be organized. I think we can't complain about that. Any other issues before we proceed? Look, in terms of the interviews themselves, in the JSC, we normally issue a questionnaire in advance to applicants or people who are to be nominated, so they answer specific questions. But here in Parliament, I think the system, the practice has been to simply, on the basis of a person's CV, ask whatever relevant questions. So in any case, an interview is an interview. One can't quite predict which questions members would want to fire. But I suppose as chair, I have the prerogative to determine whether a question is a fair question or not. And I hope my ruling would be final. But generally, there are no hard and fast rules relating to questions to the best of my knowledge that members may ask. So I'll leave it to your capable hands to probe into the candidate's ability or potential to be effective in this particular position. Are there any questions, comments before we proceed? None. All right.
Yes,
Honorable Judge.
I'm assuming that the first thing we're going to allow is to, for them, they've applied to be public protectors, so they're going to be able to to sell them.
Yes.
And I'm assuming that
would be the question that I would be asking
to
every candidate from the beginning. Yes. No, that's correct.
Okay.
You know, the Chief Justice usually asks you leading questions based on your CV. And then opens it up to members. I think I'll just, as you suggested, ask a blanket question. And then from there, hand over to you colleagues.
The candidate is Mr. Chuteng. He is already outside. Chuteng.
Yeah.
Already outside.
All right. May the first candidate come forward. Where will they be sitting? All right.
Sorry, sir. Can you,
yes,
before we start,
yeah,
apologize to each and every candidate,
yes,
for getting late?
Yes, sure. Good afternoon, Advocate Chuteng. Have I pronounced your name correctly? Please assist him to. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. And thank you for indulging us with your presence. And I must immediately apologize for the delay, for which I'm solely, entirely responsible. I've just arrived from Rome directly into this room after accompanying the speaker for some parliamentary business. You are one of eight candidates which the members of this ad hoc committee have identified based on your CV to be the most, the strongest or most promising candidates for the position of public protector. So congratulations to have made it this far.
Thank you.
I assume that you are here for an interview for the position of new public protector. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Yes, thank you. The people in front of you are the members of the ad hoc committee who are collectively and individually going to examine you to assess for themselves if they are satisfied that you are the best candidate for the position. If questions that are forwarded, are posed to you, in your opinion, are unfair, I retain the ultimate prerogative to determine that particular question. But feel free if you are not comfortable with a question. Obviously, the way we work is that we do not issue a set of questions in a questionnaire, which may be a little bit unfair, so it puts it in a little bit of a precarious situation. But unfortunately, that's how Parliament does its business, as far as I know. All right. I'll ask you only one question, and that is, if we've looked at your CV, you may want to highlight or remind us of some of the strong or salient points that emerge from your CV. But if I were to ask you, what is it that Mr. Chuteng would bring to the Office of Public Protector in terms of your knowledge, experience, skills, professional qualifications, etc.? Perhaps I should ask you two questions. The second question is a bit of an unfair question, and that is there anything that you are aware of that should place this committee in doubt as to whether or not they should recommend you for appointment, and what explanation would you want to give to this committee, if at all, to allay whatever doubts they may be having arising from that. So it's, I said it's one, but it ended up being two questions. Yes.
Before Mr. Chikte responds, I hope I heard you wrong, that he is not the strongest. He is one of the strongest, basing ourselves on his CV only. And yeah, thanks.
We have eight candidates without any order of preference who have been selected by this collective. And that was the result of agreement between all of us across different parties that this would be the most potential or the candidates with the greatest potential for appointment, and you're one of them. Maybe that clarifies the matter further. All right. My two questions.
Okay. Firstly, thank you very much for give me the opportunity to be here today. In relation to the two questions, what do I bring? I don't know if this thing is too loud. What do I bring to the Public Protector's Office? My work has been divided into two parts. Majority of it has been as an academic. I've worked at Wits University for the past 10 years, lecturing on a number of causes, constitutional law and conflict resolution particularly. And so my analytical skills, I think, are quite sound based on the research that I've done, my publications that I've done. And I also do a lot of conflict resolution work, mediations, negotiations. And I think that's a significant role of the public protector in order to be able to deal with issues of value to the state and to the citizens of South Africa. I started to become an academic, and in law particularly because of the background that I come from. I come from a very small place in Limpopo and studied under the House of Delegates education. My passion was to Polokwane. That's where I went to school in the House of Delegates, and in 1992 I went to Wits University where I was exposed to different cultures. My passion was to, when you grow up in a society of where there's discrimination and in a province with an extreme sense of poverty, and my work was dedicated to in ensuring that we look for ways to alleviate that poverty and transform society. And as an academic, initially as a student, I've been involved in student organizations at Wits University. I've organized talks on transforming Wits University itself from an institution which was which initially did not reflect the demographics of the country, to one that that reflects the gender and racial demographics of who we are in this country. So what I bring to the table is someone who has done extensive research in human rights. I've completed a PhD on the fundamental human right to strike. I look particularly at teachers in South Africa, balancing the right to strike and the right to education, because I saw the way I see South Africa, the fundamental way of transforming the country is through education. Education allows people better opportunities, allows them better jobs. And majority of South Africans support extended families. And then for me, education is a primary concern. And that's why I work at an institution that provides education to my students. The area of law that I teach is fundamentally human rights orientated. I teach constitutional law, and I teach conflict resolution. I also work in conflict resolution. For me, conflict resolution is a fundamental aspect of who we are as South Africans. We're able to resolve conflicts. We're able to come over some of the biggest atrocities through negotiations, through forgiveness, through institutions such as the TRC. And what I try and instill in my students is a sense of belonging, a sense of acceptance, a sense of looking at the other. We call ourselves a rainbow nation of different cultures. And I think the idea is to enjoy the splendor in who we are as South Africans. So what I bring to the table is someone who's committed to human rights. I think the commitment of this new government of the day is service delivery. I think that's of fundamental importance. I think there's been an outcry amongst the communities, and we've seen it. We've seen it being displayed in so many ways, some not so nice. We've seen xenophobia. We've seen an outcry amongst the community who are not happy with the conditions. I think the objective of this government is to ensure that service delivery is maintained. I think the legacy of apartheid has left us with significant imbalances and inequality. And I think the remnants of that inequality is expressed in a number of ways, through crime, through extreme social conditions under which people live. And as a person committed to human rights, I would like to ensure that service delivery is a priority. And I think it's fundamental that we understand that as South Africans. Second part of your question, is there anything that I bring to the table that I should make the committee aware of? I don't really know of anything that I should bring to the committee's attention.
You have never been found of any criminal offense. You haven't been subjected to any disciplinary action in your previous employment situation?
No. I haven't been, and there's been no criminal case against me that I'm aware of, and I have not been disciplined by any institution.
And in terms of your character as a person, how would you describe yourself? Are you the kind of person who's short-tempered at times, or are you always as cool as you appear to be in front of
I think I like to listen to people. I like people generally, and I think people are generally very different, and they bring different things to the fore. And I like listening and getting to know people. I think people are too quick to jump to conclusions when they deal with ideas that are very different from their own. And I think I'm the type of a person who'd like to learn from other cultures, other traditions. Often when you face a problem, people often don't listen to the other side and look for solutions. My work as a mediator, whereby I try to assist parties in looking at things from the other side, putting themselves in the other person's shoes, eliminating unfounded perceptions, and coming to some form of win-win solution. And I teach conflict resolution to my students, and one thing I teach them is that if you want to work as a mediator, if you want to resolve conflicts, you've got to look at yourself first. You've got to dig deep within yourself to see what type of conflicts, who you are as a person, why are you prejudiced, what instills those qualities within you. Before you try and resolve other conflicts, one's got to try and resolve one's conflicts within oneself. And I think, I mean, one doesn't always do that, but I hope that my viewpoint in life is to try and see things from other people's point of view. The way we see life is based on our culture, our upbringing, our surroundings. And as South Africans, those who grew up in the 80s, that was limited. You're limited to schools where it's only of a particular race. Your access to other cultures and other traditions were limited in those days. So obviously your perceptions and your viewpoints get restricted, and once you get exposed, you get to learn more about other people. And I think
have you had any experience of exercising leadership in any particular context? And how have you fared, in your own opinion, in discharging such a role?
I've exercised leadership in a number of institutions. Initially, as a student, I was a member of the Law Students Council, and my primary function was to organize law forums. And what I did was, it was a period of transition in South Africa. I was 92, and I tried to call speakers who would look forward towards some aspect of transformation, gender equality, to eliminate forms of racial discrimination, ways in which you could transform the university. Besides my leadership roles as a scholar, I also had leadership roles within the university itself. I ran a number of administrative departments within the university. I was the head of the Teaching and Learning Committee at Wits University. It's a very trying committee because we faced a number of difficulties at Wits University, especially in the 90s. We were trying to transform the demographics. And as an academic, but in teaching and learning, you want to ensure that we're able to deal with the imbalances, because people came from different schools, different education levels within those high schools. And when you come with different education levels within universities, clearly there's an imbalance in there. How do you eliminate that inequality and ensure that we allow and enable people to reach their full potential? I think as a leader of that particular administrative body, my primary function was to ensure that we enable people to reach their full quality and potential. I was also the academic director of the Human Rights Exchange Program, which is a program which focuses on human rights from different perspectives. It's a program run by Wits University and Bard College in the U.S. So we look at human rights and philosophy, human rights and economics, human rights and law. And we try and give people a more holistic understanding of human rights rather than one from a purely legalistic perspective. I think if you look at the CV, there's a number of other leadership roles that I've played in as well.
In terms of practical experience with the law, do you have any experience with practicing law or with law in practice? If the distinction makes any sense. How do you rate your experience in the practical application of law?
My primary function is an academic, and in addition to that, I've done work as a mediator and arbitrator. I've done arbitration in the labor context. As an advocate itself, I often provide legal opinions. I don't go to court. I'm one of those people who believes that more in mediation, and my personality is such that I'd rather resolve conflicts through discussion and through negotiation. I'm not saying there's no role for courts, because when I train people in conflict resolution, I tell them that there's a role for all forms of different appropriate dispute resolution mechanisms. Litigation is merely one of them. In addition to my academic writing and academic teaching and academic training, my practical experience has been in acting as an arbitrator and acting as a mediator. And a mediator, not only in labor conflict, but also in community conflicts, and more recently, land conflicts, because I see land conflicts are major. I mean, you see millions of South Africans landless in this country. Going to court will require these parties to wait a number of years at a great cost to acquire these rights. And I think we're trying to resolve a lot of these conflicts through mediation, through consulting with the Department of Land. And my practical experience has been in trying to resolve these conflicts in an amicable way rather than going through litigation.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I now invite colleagues who may have questions. First, I saw Ms. Markle. Yes. And then I'll have Mr. George and then Mr. Spanier. Let's start with Ms. Michael.
Thanks, Chair. Mr. Chiktay, just sort of catching on to a question that was asked you just now. I see that you are an advocate. Where did you do your pupillage, and what is your knowledge of court procedure, if you have any at all?
I'm an advocate. You don't have to do pupillage to be an advocate.
Okay.
I'm not a member of the bar.
You're not a member of the
bar. My role as an advocate is to give written opinions. The thing is that I don't practice as an advocate in court. I do arbitrations and mediations. It's very difficult to work as an academic and to practice in court at the same time, primarily because the court determines the date that you go to court. And I cannot go to court on the day that I'm teaching. I can arbitrate and I can mediate. That's one practical reason. The other reason is that I believe more in mediations and resolving conflicts through mediations rather than court. I'm not saying I don't think there's a place for court. I think there's a fundamental role for court in order to protect fundamental rights in that. It's just that it hasn't fallen within my academic career.
The choice that you made,
yeah,
to concentrate more on academia. Ms. Michael?
Chair, thank you. Just one more question, Mr. Chiktay. as the public protector, you deal with some pretty powerful people.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes you would have to make terribly unpopular decisions.
Yeah.
Do you think that you have the personality to, if need be, turn around and tell the president he's done something wrong?
I think one's got to be able to be impartial. One's got to be able to make decisions. I think at the end of the day, your role is to uphold the principles of the Constitution, your Section 9 institution, which requires your impartiality, which requires you to investigate and to ensure that the state complies with the principles of the Constitution and other legislation. At the end of the day, the South African people that are of paramount concern and paramount importance. I think one should be brave enough to stand up and make decisions that one has to make. I do believe in talking. I do believe in consultation. I don't believe in making rash decisions without consultation, because I do think that one should give other people a chance to be heard and to be able to make a decision in consultation. The president has shown that he's willing to consult and willing to talk and willing to be heard. But I'm not afraid to make a decision and investigate people if that needs to be. Because the fundamental, at the end of the day, is to protect those values in the Constitution, which we have struggled for in this country.
Michael, are you satisfied? All right. Mr. George?
Mr. Chikte, Advocate Chikte, to me, I'm going to ask a question. You know, when the issue of the public protector was introduced in this country, have you made any observations or taken any interest in what was happening in the offices of since we had public protectors in this country? And if you had, in your mind, what do you think needs to be done to improve? Should anything that is started normally, it does need improvement. Do you think there are any areas in your mind, having observed, if you have observed what's happening in the public protectorship, which you think needs improvement, which you think you can do even probably better than it the whole office was run since its inception?
I think there's enough written about the public protector, the public protector. I think Kadra Asma's report on Section 9 institutions gives enough quite a bit of input as to how the public protector can be improved. He talks about the role of Section 9 institutions as being independent from other state institutions, the legislature and the executive. He talks about the fact that it wants Section 9 institution to be a bit more vigilant in their actions and in the manner in which they carry out their duties. And that the principles of corporate government that are found in our constitution do not necessarily apply to Section 9 institutions. But the function of Section 9 institutions, particularly the public protector, is to ensure that the state is held accountable for its actions. And I think one of the criticisms against the public protector has been the fact that it's not been as vigilant as it should be. In looking at the cases that the public protector has done over the number of years, there are certain cases where it has been vigilant. What are its enforcement mechanisms apart from recommendations as well? One's going to look at the power that it has. Does it have extensive power? Should it be given more powers? Can we do that? Does the Constitution allow for that? There's been recent criticism of the public protector by Kadra Asma. All of us know about the criticisms that came about by the Mail and Guardian. The recent judgment that was made, Mail and Guardian versus the public protector. There's been a different interpretation of the facts in that particular case between what the public protector felt and what the court felt. Looking at what the court's interpretation and Kadra Asma's recommendations, the argument is there is a greater need for more vigilance on the part of the public protector. The court did not say that the public protector was being malicious in any way. It just said that there is a different interpretation and that the court and that the public protector had a very narrow interpretation of the facts in that case. I think at the end of the day, the public protector should be more vigilant in protecting the rights of South Africans. I think the new government keeps saying it's committed to that in ensuring that their service delivery, ensuring that the people of South Africa are given what is promised to them. And for me, the public protector should be more vigilant In saying that as well, there are a number of cases where he did do good work. I mean, if you look through to the cases that it did, and you also got to look at the extent of power that it does have. How much power does it have? It's not a court. Can it give recommendations? Can it go more than recommendations? Should it be assisting people in cases? I mean, that's some other issues one should consider. I mean, yeah.
Mr. Judge? All right. Okay. I then had Mr. Spagnoni, followed by Ms. Lalo.
Thank you, Chairperson. Basically, I notice you were born on the 11th of September. Last week, Thursday, was your birthday. Happy belated birthday.
Thank you.
I noticed that amongst the publications, you have written a topic, Mission Impossible, Trade Union and Protest Action Rights in the Military.
Yeah.
What were the contributions of that paper? And maybe you should also link your comment to what we have seen recently, the protest action by soldiers.
The paper was an analysis of the first Defense Force judgment, whereby Defense Force members wanted the right to form trade unions. And it was a critical analysis of that judgment. When it comes to Defense Force members, particularly, there's an academic debate in the way in which Defense Force members see themselves. There's this whole idea on whether or not they are professionals or whether they are workers. And that's an academic debate. Professionals, not the layperson's term, but the academic terms, see themselves as something beyond merely workers. They work for the sake of the actual values of that particular job. A person who is a member of the military would see himself as something beyond someone who would not necessarily worry about salaries and working conditions, but the state becomes a priority. Whereas a worker is someone who's more concerned with those other intrinsic requirements, which are necessary for life, so how much salary you're getting, where you're living, etc. In that particular case, the court had to determine whether workers have the right to form trade unions or not. I had two criticisms of the case. Number one, I felt the court misinterpreted International Labor Organization standards. The International Labor Organization did not say that Defense Force members can form unions. They said they left it to states to decide that. And I think the court misinterpreted those sections of the International Labor Organization. One question that I asked, one particular issue that I dealt with in that case, in that article, was that when you're a member of a Defense Force, who do you owe your loyalty to? And there's a danger when Defense Force members form trade unions. Do you owe your loyalty to your trade union or do you owe it to the state? And how do you deal with that difference? And I think what we've seen in the last couple of weeks was the sense of loyalty. Where does your loyalty lie? While I caution that, I do believe that people should have a voice in this country. I mean, in South Africa, the right to strike, the right to form unions, the right to form a collective has been fundamental in the overthrow of the apartheid regime. And I think, I believe Defense Force members should have a voice. They should have a way in which to express their concerns. I think the economic situation in life has changed. Defense Force members, teachers as well, they've now become workers because of harsh working conditions. But I do think one requires something more from Defense Force members. You need the loyalty, you need the state to be protected. That's essential. But at the same time, they need a voice to express their concerns. I think all of us had sympathy for the Defense Force members. Not all of us. I can't speak for all of us. But I think one could see the sympathy if they're not getting enough salaries or the working conditions were bad. But at the same time, if they're going to go about doing things in an unruly manner, they should be. That should be corrected. So that was my discussion in the particular article, and how it relates today is that today we have trade unions and Defense Force. I think whether the law says one thing or another, people need a voice to express themselves. And maybe a trade union, the fact that they have a trade union, I think, is important. But at the same time, one needs to find a balance in which their loyalty comes to South Africa. And their voice needs to be heard. And I think we could do that through negotiations and discussions. And I think as South Africans, we show the world that we can talk about our problems and can resolve it. And I think we will resolve that.
The position of the public protector will entail that you be the head of that institution with a deputy, for example, accounting to you, and also a number of staff. In case you are successful,
yeah.
I want to find out whether have you had an opportunity in your experience where you were sort of having people who were accounting to you? And if not, how do you see yourself taking control of the public protector's office?
I've had, well, within the university structures, I've run certain institutions where I've had people accountable to me as being head of the teaching and learning committee. We've had other members, and I've had to run and chair those committees themselves. As the academic director of the Human Rights Exchange Program, I've had people work in that organization, and we had to ensure that that exchange program runs effectively. The way in which I would deal with people who work, I don't know about working under me. I think you're in head of organization, but I think it's a different mindset. One's got to be running an organization as in head, and one's got to be strong enough to do that. But my mindset is very different in that we need to get the best out of people in an organization itself. And one's got to do that, not necessarily just by means of sharing authority, but by means of bringing them into the system and making them feel part of the system, making them feel heard as well, without the fear of laying down the rules when need be. So my personality is such that I'd like to work with people and get the best out of them. And it's a different mindset. It's not someone who's just authoritarian and you got to do this. But at the end of the day, what's important is that the constitutional mandate is upheld. And if people working within an organization do not do that, or do not do so effectively to the extent that South African people suffer, then that's got to be laid down.
That question can be elaborated to say, do you have any managerial skills that you could lay claim to based on your past work experience? And if so, concretely, what kind of managerial skills would you say they are?
I think we're working within the university structure itself. I've been the head of a number of committees, and my managerial skills lies within those particular committees themselves in ensuring that those committees are run effectively, ensuring that documents come out of those committee mandates, and ensuring that the members who are responsible for particular sections are accountable for that, and ensuring that everything is put together to the satisfaction of the mandate to be given by the head of those by the head of the university itself. So I have chaired a number of committees within the universities, managed those members, and managed the administrations working within those committees themselves, particularly with regard to certain projects that had to be determined by the university itself. I have been an academic director of the Human Rights Exchange Program, and that program doesn't have much staff. It's me, myself, the director, and an administrator there. But I had to manage other academics who work within that organization themselves in order to ensure that they are held accountable for the causes that they lecture.
Ms. Banyan, any further questions from you?
Maybe just the last question, Mr. Chicken. The last question is, the public protector is one of the Chapter 9 institutions there to be for the public. We've seen the president has opened a hotline. How do you see this hotline either working, complementing, or what is your view about it in general?
I think the public protector needs to be more accessible to the public. I mean, whereas there's been more information on the human rights commissions, and the public protector has not, I don't think, advertised itself as well as it should have. It's not as accessible to public, and I think these hotlines allow more access. That's if people have access to telephones, even if it's a free call. I mean, what's going to happen to those particular complaints that are made at the moment? Are those complaints going to be given effect to or not? The question is, what happens to those complaints? Also, who has access to telephones? Do majority of people in this country have access to telephones? Who are we trying to reach? Are there other ways to reach these people? Should we be going on the ground and saying, look, this is the public protector, this is who we are, we're here to help you? If there's no service delivery in your municipality, you come to us and we're going to investigate that. I think it allows further access to the public protector. But whether it works or not depends on what's happening on the other end of the line, what's going to happen to that complaint, how it's going to be enforced. It's not just creating a hotline for the sake of creating a hotline. It's about enforcing it and making it a difference in people's lives.
Thank you, Chairperson. That's all from my side.
Lanza, and then I'll have to that Mr. Ndabeni. All right, Ms. Lanza.
Chairperson, I hate it when ANC people think alike all the time, because Mr. Sibanyeni has stolen both of my questions. But I think just as a follow-up to the second question that he asked, when you left home, after you were told that you've been shortlisted,
yeah,
did you speak to your domestic worker and gardener, if you have any, about whether or not they do know about the public protector and what the work of a public protector is?
I actually don't have either. I don't have either. But people I've spoken to, people who academics at university, people who work at administrative staff at university, cleaners at the university, not all of them knew about it. Some of the academics knew about the public protector. I mean, most of the academics knew about the public protector. But it's not as well known as, for example, the CCMA. Everyone knows the CCMA. And I think it's a reality, though. I mean, I think one needs to create more awareness of the public protector. It's a fundamentally important institution. And if more people were aware of it, they'd be able to enforce their rights. You know, they give more access to institutions which could assist them in enforcing their rights. Yeah.
I think then furthermore, what then, having responded to the question that you asked, I'd like you to be more practical.
Yeah.
What then would you do to ensure that people find access to the public protector? Because what that would then entail, based on your response, is that there's quite a number of people, a large portion of our population, would not even know that there is a public protector, let alone what it is that the work of a public protector is. What then would you be doing to ensure that people know that there is such a structure or such an office, and how could they access it, and for what would they access it for?
I think the hotline is one way of doing it. I think the other way is to get on the ground and go to the people. I think we go to rural areas, have better, more workshops, have better education, explain to people that they have access to these rights, have more posters in all official languages within municipalities, have these rights explained to people on the ground itself. And I think, I don't know how much of that is being done at the moment. Personally, I haven't seen much of that, and the people I've spoken to haven't seen much of that. And I think that's what one's got to do. One's got to educate the masses about the fact that the public protector is there to help them. What does it do? You know, all official languages, and so the layperson can actually understand that you have this organization out there that's there to assist them. And I think you need to do that with most of the other Section 9 institutions as well, not only the public protector. But anyway.
But I thought I had a further question.
Yeah.
Relate to what concretely, you know, having been accessed, the public protector then able to do. It's one thing to make yourself accessible and advertise yourself, and people
yeah.
come and queue, and then the next thing, nothing changes. They're still in the same situation that they were before they came to you. What is it once you wish to?
I think the public protector's mandate. Look at the Act and you look at the Constitution itself. It has a number of units. There's a legal unit in there itself. I think first you've got to assess the problem and you've got to see whether it's a type of problem that falls within your mandate. Is it something against the state? Is it against a private body? If it's against the state, there's different ways in which to resolve it. I think the first way, if you look at the first way is to see if the party person has have themselves attempted to resolve the problem internally. If they have not, maybe that's you've got to find out why they have not. Attempts to resolve it internally, if it's because of some fear that they may have of either discrimination or they've tried and it's failed, then we've got to look at alternative ways. Initially by the public protector speaking to them, through conciliation, through mediations, and where that fails, the public protector could send them to other institutions in order to arrange for litigation if that need be. At the same time, the public protector can recommend from the state institution why it has not done so. It can do it can require them to give feedback. But then
no, the public protector can litigate himself. He has to forward such a complaint to some other body to litigate in the event
I think
it's a litigious matter. And what would that body be?
I think there's different actors and places. I mean, you have the South African Human Rights Commission, which basically can litigate if it's issues pertaining to equality. It can go to the Equality Court. There's law clinics that the state provides. And there's other legal aid institutions that provide assistance to people who need assistance when it comes to litigation. And I think one needs a greater synergy between the different Section 9, Chapter 9.
See that factor as a limitation on the part of the public protector of not being able to pursue a matter to its natural conclusion?
I think it is a limitation to an extent. I mean, to some extent, it has the power to talk and to resolve problems through conversation. And what it's been doing is a lot of its cases has been through conversation and through recommendations that it's been made. But I do think it's a limitation where you can't litigate further. I don't know if it's because of resources or because the drafters of the Constitution had another mandate for doing that, but I do think it is a limitation.
Okay. All right. Was there another hand before I come to Ms. Ramudibe that I missed? Are you now cut?
My colleague, but only one question.
All right.
Advocate Sikte, you have said that you are involved in mediation,
yeah,
more particularly in land claims. Can you refer us to any that you have mediated?
I think my work is predominantly in labor mediations. I've done a great deal of labor mediations. Land mediation, in the process of dealing with one in, it's very difficult for me to reveal private information pertaining to a particular, because there'll be a breach of confidence in those particular cases. So without giving specific names, there have been cases in close to Pretoria where there have been claims for land from certain communities and from the landowner, from the person who's been renting the land itself, and the landowner, which has been the state in that particular case, the dynamics in land are difficult. I mean, the people have different rights. They have rights in terms of ESTA, they have rights in terms of ownership, they have rights in terms of contract. And the mediation, in mediating those conflicts, one's got to be able to balance those rights. At the same time, you've got to understand that you've got to have some sympathy for the communities that live there. I mean, the community that I dealt with, parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, have graves in that land. They've never owned that land. The land is owned by the state. You have another institution, another person who's leasing that land through the state. And for some reason or another, failed to give effect to the community's burdens. And you've got to balance this particular interest itself. It's a long history of struggle for land rights. That one's got to balance those rights together with the rights of the new owner as well. So without giving names of particular cases itself, that the complexities of land conflicts are very different from the complexities of labor, so the labor mediations that I deal with. But on the other hand, the labor mediations that we're dealing with today are quite, especially with this economic climate and the retrenchments that we're seeing today. I mean,
are you satisfied? All right. The last question would be from, we have another. So you'd be the last, all right. Let's just start with Ms. Ramudibe.
Thank you, Chair. Advocate, I would like to know what specifically attracted you to this position. And also, one of the functions of the Human Rights Commission is to monitor and assess the observance of human rights in the Republic.
Yeah.
In your view, what impression do you have? Is it doing enough in as far as you are concerned?
The Human Rights Commission.
Yes.
I don't think there's ever an answer like, is it doing enough? I think there's much more that can be done by the Human Rights Commission itself. I think it is doing some work pertaining to equality cases, access to information, where it has a mandate in those two. I think much more can be done to in relation to the Human Rights Commission. One aspect is should it be doing more in intervening in criminal issues itself. I mean, is that not a human rights issue when people who they lose their lives, their constitutional right to life, to property, etc.? Another issue is, has it done enough pertaining to the xenophobia that we've seen last year? Critics say that it did not. But however, there have been a number of reports that the Human Rights Commission has written in the early part of 2003-2004, and if those had been put into effect and put into practice much earlier, hopefully we could have alleviated some of those problems. So when it comes to the Human Rights Commission, also it had a Millennium Workshop in June this year, whereby it called government and it called civil society to present on a number of issues pertaining to alleviation of poverty, child mortality, environmental rights, etc. But what it fails to do is create much more synergy between civil society and the state itself. And I think there could be more work done within the Human Rights Commission pertaining to that. Rather, it does do some good work. It does some good workshops. It's won some significant cases in the Equality Court, specifically pertaining to discrimination. So there's always more that can be done.
Just before you ask, there's an issue that had arisen with a previous public protector where a complaint was lodged against another constitutional institution, which may have not necessarily been a Chapter 9 institution as such. And the public protector made a report, and one of the debates was whether one constitutional institution can investigate within the parameters, of course, of its mandate, another constitutional institution. I'm just reminded by this question that she's asking with regard to the Human Rights Commission specifically.
So is your question pertaining to
my question is, do you, in your opinion, believe that it is within the rights of the public protector and in Chapter 9 institution to investigate a complaint leveled against another constitutional institution, especially another Chapter 9 institution, if the matter relates specifically to the mandate of the public protector as outlined in the constitution itself or the legislation governing the public protector?
Okay. That's an interesting question. The question and the mandate is to investigate basically abuse by the state or delays by the state. And it comes into question as to whether or not these institutions form part of the state. In Kader Asmal's analysis of Section 9 institutions, he indicated they do not form part of the state. They're outside the state. They're there to check on the legislature and the executive. And I think it's subject to interpretation. If you use that form of interpretation, we could argue that these institutions do not form part of the state. But I think it gets deeper than that as well. Are they forming some form of state function? Are they forming some form of function of pertinence to the state? And I think it relates to what type of complaint you're dealing with, I would say.
My immediate reaction would be that any public institution that performs
a
state function, constitutional or statutory, the state institution. I would think that the state is broader than government.
And the legislature, executive, and judiciary.
The state is the legislature is part of the state. So is the courts, I believe,
yeah.
And so is government and all other institutions. So, but I really don't want to.
It's a debate, but I think at the end of the day, let's look at what the fundamental principle is. What is the purpose? Why do we have the public protector? The public protector is there to ensure that individuals, there's no abuse by the state or any form of rights that may come from state institutions. So in that sense, you make a good argument in that looking at the purpose, instead of letting the tail wag the dog, look at what's the fundamental purpose of why you have the particular institution itself and maybe interpret it from that particular perspective. Having a more value-oriented interpretation of the functions of the public protector. But I think it's a debate, and it's an interesting debate that one can argue both sides. But I think for the purposes of practicality and for the purpose of protecting the people, which is what the Constitution's about, I think they shouldn't have a right, they should probably have a right to do so. I mean, one could say the same thing the other way around. If the public protector violates certain fundamental human rights, could they not be investigated by the Human Rights Commission? If there's gender issues, discrimination or particular gender issues in any of the Section 9 institutions, why can't the gender body investigate it? I mean, there's various ways to look at that. But I think it allows for greater checks and balances and greater accountability and better democracy. So maybe it's a better way of looking at things.
I think we'll leave it at that. Ms. Samadira, do you still have further questions? They are covered. There was one last hand, and then we will release you. Yes?
Thank you, Jefferson. Thank you very much. Advocate, if you are in the office and then your decision has been opposed by the people that you have taken the decision against,
How
would you react? Because I listened carefully when you say that you resolved the conflict by listening to people, want the people to participate and so on and so forth. Now, all of us here are opposed to your decision. And then how are you going to react in that manner? You are the head of this section, and most of us that you are consulting are opposed to what you think should be done. And then the person that you want to investigate or whatever is opposed to that and so on and so forth. How would you react to that?
I think one's got to stand up for one's principles at the end of the day. I mean, firstly, if you're opposed to something that I suggest, one can't just be arrogant enough to say, look, I'm right. I want to know why you're opposing it, what are your reasons, what are your justifications, and what are explanations. If I disagree with you and I think there's certain fundamental rights that the public are going to suffer at the expense of your decision, and I think it needs to be investigated, then it will need to be investigated. But at the end of the day, it's not about investigating it just because someone disagrees with me. It's not out of arrogance. At the end of the day, it's about those principles that are fundamentally important. And whatever, it's about upholding the mandate of the public protector. And I think that's important.
Last question. In the work of the public protector, there are sections where they talk about confidentiality of the matter and so on and so forth. Then tomorrow, we are visited by the people who don't identify themselves. They put a gun on top of your head because you're a public protector. They find you maybe one of their friends home. Where we're having liquor or tea or whatever, they put a gun on top of your head. They've just investigated somebody that is not supposed to be investigated, according to them.
Mm.
And that thing is very, very much confidential. If it can leak, it can destroy maybe him or her or the country.
Yeah.
How would you react to that?
I think, if you take up a position like this, I think what's important is to uphold the values of that particular position. I mean, one shouldn't talk. If the person wants to kill you and your job is to uphold, I mean, the country is bigger than any individual. It's important that it comes first. I mean, I think this job is serious. It is, it does put your life at risk. And I think one has to undertake doing this job with some form of integrity. And that integrity means upholding the principles of this job. And at the end of the day, it means protecting the values of the South African citizens.
Are you satisfied? All right. I think this is where we will end it, except that if you have any question that you would like to ask the committee, it's your opportunity now to do so.
Can I make a comment? I don't have a question. Just a comment. Look, I know you call me Advocate Chikta. I never call myself that. I don't call myself, I don't work as an advocate apart from giving opinions.
You are admitted.
I am admitted, but often use my other title, which is Dr. Chikte, is the academic title, because my work is predominantly as an academic. But I don't mind titles, you can call me Ali as well. Just a number of things to say. I know I'm probably maybe I'm a bit younger than some of the other applicants. Maybe I've got a bit less managerial experience. I don't know if that will be held against me, the fact that I'm a Pachanga. But I do think I bring some form of new energy to this particular position. I think it's a position that I will bring integrity to this particular position, and I'm sure all the other candidates will as well. And I think at the end of the day, for me, what's important is that the public protector performed its functions based on the constitutional values that we fought for in this country. And for me, that's the of paramount importance. And I once again thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You are excused.
Thank you.
The ST already, I suspect that the best way to handle this is to rather break for a short period to have a quick cup of coffee and then immediately proceed with the next candidate. Yes, yes.